Good morning. I have a small personal story to relate this morning. I'll start out, which is part of what I'm speaking of. Doug and I spoke in the very beginning when he asked me if I would speak here before the first time, if I would speak on some of my experiences in the metaphysical world and what I had experienced through my study. He asked about incidents that I had been exposed to. I thought about it for a while, and it's hard to put things in personal things out to people, particularly people that you really don't know intimately or haven't known long. So this second time, I figured, well, I'm 83 years old. What am I afraid of? As the Bible says, God loves me. Who can I fear? So, I will share a personal story. I was in a relationship with a German man who was a product of Nazi Germany's breeding of the super race. He was 9 when the Allies won the war, and he was allowed to proceed with as normal a life as was possible for him. He had a lot of insecurities because of that upbringing, and he also had a lot of excuses. He was a brilliant man. He was very smart, nothing stupid about him, but he kept saying he was, and everybody thought he was, and you couldn't convince him otherwise. It took me 50 years before I got him to go into a church. But he got there, and he finally discovered, hey, I'm all right. But that was about the end of his life. We were together 53 years. He died on the 20th of sepsis. I knew immediately when I met him that I knew him. I don't know recollections about him. From the first time we spoke, we became friends. And we didn't part from that time on. We didn't leave together for the first 20 years. He had his own house, I had my own. And it was very good because he was very arrogant and independent. And I was always, at that time, I was still a very small mouse. I had a lot of insecurities myself, and I was very extremely shy. And it took him, because he was so arrogant, to get me to open up. And I got to meet people then through him. And after a while, I guess I acquired some of his personality, because I wasn't shy anymore. I could go out and meet people, and I could have good conversations and make friends on my own. But before that, it never happened. It was just a strange thing. When he died, he asked me, which is strange, to have his ashes spread on the property we had just bought up in Scaly Mountain. We had built before, 20 years before, a big house further back, and we had sold it. And so we had just moved into this house, and by this time he was quite ill. So I was quite surprised when he said he wanted me to spread his ashes, because it's so impermanent. I won't be there forever. And I was only 7 years younger than him. So I thought to myself, what? But I did. I waited a year, like he said, and I spread his ashes. So we had a little dog named Keats. And Keats loved me, but he tolerated Edward. And when I wasn't around, that was his best buddy. And this is where it comes together. Edward died 1 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. Keats died at 1 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. And January, both. And he was 18 when he died. So I was, that was sort of something that I hadn't considered, until he asked me if I would come up with something. I have resumed painting. I've always painted. I have a natural talent to do drawings, landscapes, seascapes, flowers, you name it. And it comes easy to me. I never had a teacher. The only teaching I had was I had to learn how to mix colors. So I did buy books and I did attend several classes on how to, on color theory. And I know how to do that now. It's been a while and I started to take my painting up again. And Edward used to bother me because he used to like to take pictures of me painting. And if any of you paint or do anything creative that way, you know you cannot really produce if you have somebody hovering around you. It doesn't work. This is why you have a studio or something where you can get away and shut the door. And you have the world and it's your world. And you're creating a new world on an easel or a piece of paper on a desk. So lately this year, I've done on commission four. I'm in the mountains and I've done four seascapes. Think about it. My neighbors are all Floridians and they ask me, right away, can you paint us a seascape? Can you do something with water smashing against rocks? And all? Well, for me, that's easy. I grew up in California, and right near us was Stinson Beach, just north of San Francisco. And that was my playground. And I have a very good memory. This is one thing that infuriates most people. My memory is still, at this age, very good. So I remember, you know, those scenes, and I can paint them. I can duplicate them. So I've started to paint. But the thing is, out of the periphery of my eyes, when I think I'm really getting into it, I sense somebody near me. And if I look out the corner of my eye, I see this slender figure with his hunched over shoulders, which is the way he looked the last 3 years of his life. And that's him. And then all of a sudden it rushes out because it's in the corner and I can look out into my rose garden. And that's what I planted there, because he likes roses and gladiolus. So they're blooming now. He saw that when he came to the house. So my experience has been in life that I always had a glimmer of how to do things, and I had to do it on my own, and I do. I grew up in rural California in the 40s and 50s, and I had no connection through that period with things that could have given me the least or a bit of understanding of how to do anything. My parents were older. I was the baby. And my sister and two brothers were grown and gone when I was a child. So I was raised as an only child. And everybody around me was old. So I was a kid and in a rural area with no other kids other than when I went to school. And when I was going to school, everybody in our neighborhood were newcomers. We had Swedes, Danes, Spaniards, Italians, Japanese, you name it. And our school was small. It was three grades in one building. And so this is the kind of background I came from. You know, you read about it and see about it. Nobody lives that way anymore. Well, I guess I'm the last remnant of that time. That's before California got settled. You know, after World War II in the 50s, huge migration from the Midwest into that area. Anyway, I reflect that I must have had a previous life, because even now, say the electrical goes off, I know how to fix it. I've never had any experience with it, but I can fix it. If the plumbing, something's going wrong in my house, I know my house well enough now. I know what's wrong with it. So if I think I can handle it, I do. But otherwise, when I call a plumber, I know what to tell him, so he doesn't go around finding extra work. Things get taken care of. So I've managed to become proficient in gardening and, of course, in cooking. But cooking is easy because I know what I like and my dislikes. It's all been trial and error, but mostly error, because I know what I like. And so in the beginning, I was very heavy-handed with herbs. And you don't want to get there. But so it took me several years before I learned how to hold back on the herbs. And I believe the soul is immortal, for it keeps finding new vessels to inhabit. I believe that is us. That is why we have the talents that we are born with, which are inexplicable. And I think it explains why we have child prodigies who have no talent, or their parents don't have any talent, and yet they're born and they can sing, they can play piano, they can write music, they can invent things when they're 3, 5, 6 years old. And how is that possible? And the only way that's possible is if you had a previous life. In the Tibetan Book of the Dead, they describe it this way. The soul is that which is the deepest personal essence of a living being, which journeys from life to life and takes rebirth, and which becomes enlightened finally. The Buddha's famous teaching of selflessness has often been translated in the past as soullessness, soullessness, and was used to confirm to the Western sense that Buddhism is nihilistic and atheistic. The Buddha rejected any absolute, unchanging, fixed, intrinsically substantial, intrinsically indefinable soul, just as he rejected the same kind of self or ego. But relative, changing, rational, living, conventional entities that can usefully be termed ego, self, and soul are never prohibited in the Buddhist psychology. The extremely subtle body-mind very much qualifies as the soul of the being who is undergoing death, the between, the liberation, and in-between. In the New Testament, soul, in Greek psyche, refers to the living being of the whole person. In the Hellenistic philosophy, Plato in the Myth of Air in the Republic argues for the pre-existence of souls. He also makes the same argument in the Phaedo, which is a short book. The Republic, you know, you've got to have to really be a book lover to read that. But you can read the Phaedo in about half an hour. And if you can find it, read it, Google it. You will find it fascinating because he argues for the soul. Some early Christian thinkers, like Origen, believed that the earthly body was a prison in which the soul was bounded for some evil that he had committed in the heavenly realm. So think of this. We're all heavenly persons trapped in these bodies. So that's a good thought to have. As to the immortality of souls, the clearest example may be found in Revelation, where the souls of the beheaded for testifying to Jesus were asked to rest a little longer until the final judgment. It's Revelation 24, where it says, "I also saw the souls of the first resurrection." Soul lives after death, as in Luke 9:25. "And by your endurance you will gain your souls." That's in Luke 21:9. I thought of myself when I was writing that, having my coffee. Judaism and Christianity, which is a sect of Judaism, have a belief of a part of us surviving after death. In strict Judaism, we survive in the memory and the good works we do in this life, and that is our eternity. While the Christians believe that we survive completely, with even memories of who we were and cognizant of many people that we interacted with at the time we were alive. In my mind, from all I've read and heard, I believe that we are like a cell in a great cognizant being who is aware, and just like our bodies are made of many cells which die constantly and are replaced until the day the body dies. This, I believe, explains the reason our scientists tell us that the universe will implode to a singular point again, from which again there will be occur another Big Bang, with the cycle occurring into eternity. string theory proposes that, and that what we believe are solid objects are just vibrating hadrons, gluons, and whatever else they've thought of lately. And it's strange, you know, there is a theory that Jesus Christ spent the missing parts of his years between 12 and 30 in the Far East. When he was teaching, he called his teachings the way. Well, in the Tao, and Tao means the way. So Tao is the pervading, self-existent, eternal cosmic unity, the source from which we all are created and things emanate and to which they all return. The idea of the soul, the male and the female, yang and yin, light and dark, spiritual and physical souls, that all goes back to the way and the teachings of Christ. So, you know, I find it very credible to believe that, what they propose some of the students of the Bible when they're trying to explain everything that happens in our life. And there is a small little saying that I have, and it's been my prayer even before I discovered religion. And when I talk to some of the people who have taught me religion, they ask me, where did I learn that prayer? And I always say, it just came out of nowhere. And when I pray to the great being, I don't have a name for him. It's a being. And the being resides in me. I always asked to be pleased that he be in my life this day, every day, in every way. Thank you.